G'day, and welcome to the AHDC podcast series, Health Design on the Go. I'm your host, David Cummins, and today we're speaking to Sarah Marbury, healthcare and senior living design knowledge expert and marketing consultant and writer. Sarah began her career as a communications specialist, traveling across America and Europe when fate introduced her to the world of health design, and she hasn't looked back. Sarah had a strong career in the world of health design, and as a communication specialist, we welcome her to our series on the art of communication for health design. Welcome, Sarah. Thank you for your time.
Hey, David. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I was just speaking to you earlier, and you were talking about how you started your career in communication. So how did you end up from communication into the world of health design? It seems like a bit of a stretch for some people.
When I graduated from college, I went to work for the Merchandise Mart here in Chicago. I still live in the Chicago area, and the Merchandise Mart is the world's largest design center. So I was introduced to this whole world of design that I knew nothing about. And I worked for the Mart for a couple of years, and then I moved to the New York area, and I started working for a magazine called Contract Magazine as an editor. And there I learned everything there was to know about commercial interiors and peripherally knew something about healthcare, but wrote a couple of articles on healthcare projects and stuff. But mostly the focus at Contract Magazine was on corporate offices. So healthcare wasn't a big deal back then. This was in the early 80s. But I was at a conference one spring, I think it was, and I met a man at this conference who walked up to me and said, "Hi, my name is Wayne Ruga, and I'm starting a healthcare design conference." And like any editor or reporter does, I just said, "Oh, yes, send me information on it." Well, Wayne not only sent me information, but he got me involved. He invited me to be on the advisory committee, and he also invited me to be the MC of the very first event that was held in 1988 in Carlsbad, California. And so I ended up being the MC of that event for 10 years. And it was an amazing thing because when that first symposium was held, it was the first time that people in the healthcare design field came together as a group, designers and providers and product manufacturers. So it was really kind of the birth of that industry here in the United States.
Yeah, that's phenomenal because the birth of Australia with research and health design in Australia has probably only been around for about 10 plus years. So for that to have happened so long ago is very, very amazing. In Australia, we've got the Australian Health Design Council. We're starting to get a lot more research into the world of health design. But I would say America and certainly Europe have been the leaders in that. So to be part of that birthing of such a great movement must be very exciting.
Yeah, it really was. My hat goes off to Wayne because he was the visionary who brought these incredible people together. And he put people on the board that were doing amazing work. And he brought speakers to the event who were just incredible. And so it was this period where it was kind of like when you come to the symposium, you're like, "I found my people." These are people who understand that the design of the physical environment affects patient and staff outcomes. There was a lot of excitement around it. From the symposium, I was also one of the founding board members of the Center for Health Design, which is a nonprofit research, education, advocacy organization. And we founded the center because we wanted to fund research. And you had to be a nonprofit to fund research or get funding from government agencies to fund research. And so that was really the impetus for pulling that organization together. And the center still exists today and is still leading the charge in the area of evidence-based design and research for healthcare facilities.
I would say most people listening would know about that. And if you don't, you've been under a rock because it's very, very world famous, that research. I personally have a physiotherapy background. So we were always taught, and the way I was always brought up is, what does the research say? Where basically you're not allowed to have an opinion because if the research doesn't support it, it probably isn't there. You can have theories, but what does the research say? How is that better? And so I've actually brought that into the world of health design where you try and find best practice because that has the best clinical outcome. So I absolutely love what you've done and very grateful for what you've done. I think a lot of architects and patients and practitioners and hospitals have benefited from what you guys started years ago.
Yeah, it truly is remarkable. I had a personal experience 2 years ago when my mother was in the hospital. She had suffered from Alzheimer's for 13 years. And at the end of her life, she had a fall. She was near 90, and we made a decision to put her into hospice care in the local hospital. And when I arrived at the local hospital, to this hospice unit, and I went to my mother's room where my father and my brother and my sister were. It was this amazing patient room. It had all these windows. It had a family zone. When I entered the room, they were playing the Care Channel, which actually used to be one of my clients, but it's music and video that is nature programming. And so later I said something to one of the nurses. I said, wow, you guys have done everything right here. You've created a patient room that really supports the patient and the family. And she said to me, oh yeah, that was very important to us. And we wanted to make sure that it cut down on the family stress and it really did provide a healing environment for the patient. And I thought, bingo, that's why we started the Center for Health Design and we did all this work, the work I've been doing. It was so gratifying to hear somebody on the caregiver side, she got it. So it validated all the work that I've been involved with all these years.
Yeah, and that's humbling to hear. And I certainly in Australia, our design is certainly that way as well, where it's not just a place where sick people heal. It's a place of wellness. It's a place for collaboration. It's a place for grieving. It's a place for coming together. It's a place for families and for staff. I certainly think the world of health design, certainly in the last 15 years since I've been in it, has certainly evolved. What do you think some of the changes have been that you've seen in the last probably, what, 40 years, is it now?
Well, not quite. It's probably like 30 that I've been involved, 30-something that I've been involved in the field. I'm fascinated with history. I think that we can learn a lot from history, and I do a lot of going back and looking at things. I think very few things are ever really new. I mean, when we put wheels on our suitcases, that was pretty new. But in the world of healthcare design, the things that happened that were breakthrough were things that happened in those 80s and 90s where we were looking at the importance of single patient rooms and we were looking at things like noise and access to nature and natural light. And these are still things that we're doing today. So I think what has changed, though, and what will continue to change is the technology that will influence how health facilities of any kind are designed. And I think we're going to see more smart buildings where the building itself, the building systems, the furniture, the materials in it will all be collecting data that can inform design and really tell the building owners how the people are using the space, how their staff is using the space. So I think that technology is what is pushing us into new areas where we have to find more creative and innovative ways to address things. But some of those things that we discovered 20, 30 years ago are still the mainstay of what is good design in the healthcare field.
What do you think some of the biggest, not necessarily changes, but the biggest improvements to patient care have been through design in those years? You mentioned nature, you mentioned greenery, you mentioned natural light. So do you think there have been the stable benefits for patients over those years? Because still, I would say, certainly in Australia, we do try to enhance those principles as much as we can, but sometimes we have natural light looking into a brick wall. So how do we find that balance for such important design principles for patient care?
Well, there's other ways to bring nature in besides a window. There's artwork and there's interactive artwork and things like that. It's not the same as looking at a real tree or being outside, but I think that the patient experience itself has benefited from this awareness that the design of the physical environment can impact the stress levels of both patients and staff. And so that is something that in the early, when we designed these hospitals in the 40s and we buttoned everything up and they were all white and they were sterile and everybody was concerned with cleanliness, but they weren't really concerned with the senses and how people interacted with the environment. And I think that that's top of mind right now. And it's also top of mind that it's not just about the patients, it's about the caregivers as well. We have to create supportive environments for the caregivers and not just throw them into these sterile, windowless environments. And so I think that that thinking has radically changed in the last 30 years.
Yeah, there was certainly a project I worked on a few years ago where they absolutely made the surgeons and the nurses the number one priority. And the environment with which they were working was some of the best working environments I've ever seen. And the amount of staff retention there, the lack of sick days, the amount of morale that's increased, the clinical outcomes from this place has been phenomenal, all because they focus on the staff for their staff areas where they had common areas. And it's just amazing. Like, it was, as I said, it was one of the best environments I've ever seen. And the research is there to prove that people actually, they're spending most of their life at that work. So they actually should improve that.
that's great data to have, because then you can take that to the leaders and say, look, this is the return on your investment. We can do all this stuff because we know it's good for us, but healthcare is a business. So it's also got to make good business sense to these leaders that are making the decisions to spend the money and follow the advice of the architects and the designers to do something different.
Yeah. So what's something America generally is the world leader in and always gets right in health design?
Well, I think that varies. But I think there's a lot of health facilities around the world that still have double patient rooms, and that really doesn't exist here anymore. The research was so strong about preventing infection, and now everybody understands this. COVID has made everybody understand nobody's building any hospitals with double patient rooms, and even ones that had them are renovating and making them all single patient rooms.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but during COVID, obviously there was a huge influx in places like New York, where there was just such high populace of people and people were being treated in corridors and so forth. Is it not true that a lot of hospitals in America hadn't prepared for isolation rooms? That was what we were hearing over here. Or is this the huge volume of people that were relying on the health system? That's where infection control procedures weren't being followed.
Yeah, I think it has more to do with volume than the fact that there weren't isolation rooms. And typically, isolation rooms are just a small portion. There may be only a few beds dedicated to that. And when you have hundreds and thousands of people coming to your hospital that are sick with the virus, you can't possibly turn the beds in your hospitals into isolation rooms. But that's certainly where the current thinking is how do we look at these? Everybody calls it design for flexibility, but how can we adapt spaces for different uses at different times? And I like to think that that's more about resiliency than it is flexibility. Everything we're talking about in the wake of COVID is how do we build facilities that are resilient to these health emergencies? And certainly in America, there are certain healthcare organizations that have very sophisticated isolation units, and Emory University is one of them that has done a lot of research in that area. So not every hospital has what I would say is the A-level isolation rooms, but most of them are equipped to have some degree of isolation rooms in them. It was just the volume that overcame them.
Yeah, okay. I mean, every hospital had images like that, but certainly the images we saw in America were quite distressing, just the sheer volume of some hospitals, and it was obviously patients and staff got impacted negatively from that wave. So what would be something that America can improve on with your design?
Something that America could improve upon. Well, I think that what I just mentioned is a big thing, being able to adapt spaces to different uses. This has been a trend in America in a while, I think all over the world, but the use of outdoor spaces and really incorporating them with intent and purpose into healthcare facilities, and knowing that you may have staff that are indoors with all this protective equipment on all the time, but where can they go to take it off? Well, outdoors is a perfect example of that. So I think the integration of outdoor spaces is going to continue to be very key. But everybody's talking about what I call resilience, but this flexibility and adaptability and being able to pivot like that.
Yeah, it's something Australia does very well. We do prioritize a lot of outdoor space. Obviously, we've got great climate. So a lot of outdoor space, a lot of indoor-outdoor space as well. We've actually got a podcast series on the importance of landscape architecture and how it improves patient care. So we do prioritize that a lot because we generally have more space and, as I said, the better climate, which is important as well.
Certainly, there's a lot of areas where things can be improved, and there's a lot of inner city hospitals that struggle with a lot of these issues because, like you said, they don't have the land to make outdoor spaces, or they don't have the money, their city, their county. So I think there is that. You have the haves and have-nots in America. But the good news is I think that there is more of a widespread recognition that the design of the physical environment is really important to outcomes. And even if the only outcome is preventing the spread of infection.
Yeah, exactly. I know you don't identify yourself as a researcher, but you've obviously done a lot of research. You're obviously very well versed in the world of health design. What do you think is some of the areas that need more research in the reference to, is it patient care? Is it the patient journey? Is it infection control? Is it the importance of mental health? What areas do you think people haven't really touched on that requires a lot more research?
I think that the research in all areas could still be bumped up. When we did our first lit review for the Center for Health Design back in, oh gosh, I can't remember when it was, like 94, the researchers found 83 credible studies that linked the design of the physical environment to outcomes. And then a couple of years later, when it was redone, it was 400 studies. And then the last time a comprehensive lit review was done, I think that the number was 2,000. And that's still relatively small in the realm of research. But now on the Center for Health Design's knowledge repository, there's over 6,000. They're not all research articles. A lot of it is research, but also other types of resources that talk about the design of the physical environment. So in terms of areas that could use more, it's certainly one that is very well researched is nature. I don't think we need any more nature research. I think certainly as a result of COVID, there's a lot of research on infection control and how design can mitigate that. I think we still need more on that.
One of the best articles I've read is by researcher Dr. Jane Carthy, and she actually dissected into the benefits of better user groups for the process of health design. And her research found there was basically minimal research into the world of user groups because everyone has been taught how to do it. But her research completely broke that glass ceiling saying, actually, we've been doing it wrong, where you can't actually have a cookie cutter approach to the world of user groups because at the end of the day, every user is different. Your stakeholder is different. Every hospital is different. And so this whole idea of every 2 weeks, and I personally used her research quite in depth at one project years ago, and we actually improved our design program by over 8 weeks. Yet another team on a very similar project, it actually got pushed out by 6 months, purely because they weren't using the basic principles of collaboration, consulting, understanding, respect. And they'll push into a program as opposed to push into the needs of the hospital and the patients and the users. So I found that really interesting. I always think more research into the process of design thinking, into the process of consulting, into the process of how do we actually get better outcomes from the needs of the stakeholders and the patients. I find that process very interesting to try and actually improve it, because if you can enhance and streamline that process, you'll actually get better clinical outcomes as well.
Yeah. And I think that's very interesting. Not being a practitioner, that's not quite what I think about first. And I'm more about like, what are the things that people are grappling with that need more validation? One that comes to mind is this whole issue of neurodiversity and how do we design environments for people with different psychological and social needs? And if we do, does it really matter? There's not a lot of research on that. And another area I'm particularly interested in is the idea of a healthy building, and a healthy building that does not harm people or the planet. So in healthcare, there are buildings that come close to that. But as far as I know, nobody set out to say, we're going to design a healthy building. We're going to make this hospital healthy, that it does not harm the people or the planet. There's a lot of green design. There's a lot of green hospitals in America who've gathered research on the benefits of their green design, but this merging of the environments that do not harm people, there's not a lot on that. Again, it's intuitive. We know if we design spaces that support people, they're going to be happier and more productive, and they're not going to leave their jobs. But I don't think there's a lot of good research to back that up. And the Well Building Institute is an emerging organization here that has its whole well building design standards. And there hasn't been a lot of research to look at, okay, here's a building that's been designed according to these well building standards. Did it really achieve the outcomes that we wanted it to? And so I think there's a lot more to be done in that area.
Yeah, I think you're still part of the Paris Agreement where you're trying to drop emissions, but America would have their own emissions target, would they not? Australia's got emissions target reduction, I think it's 30% in the next few years to 50% to 80% to 100% type thing over the next 40 plus years. I imagine America would have similar, where pretty much if you're designing a building now, you have to account for those emission targets as well, would you not?
There's no regulations that are really mandating that. Our federal government did come out with a pledge earlier this year that they wanted healthcare organizations to sign to say that they would reduce emissions by, I can't remember if it was zero or if it was zero net by some year. I can't remember the exact details, but there's no government regulation that mandates that. It's more like if you think it's a good thing, you're going to do it. And certainly there's organizations like Healthcare Without Harm that have been promoting this and getting healthcare organizations all over the world to sign on to reduce their carbon emissions. But right now it's voluntary. You do it because it's the right thing and maybe it makes good business sense, which it does.
I think America is actually the first worst polluter in the world of healthcare as an operator. I think you're about 10 to 12%, and Australia is actually the second worst polluter at about 7%, with the global average being about 3.5%. Don't quote me on those numbers, but I'm pretty sure I'm close. So Australia is basically double the world average, and you guys are worse than the double as America, as an entity for the world of healthcare. So obviously it's a 24-hour operating hospital, but a lot of people just say, oh, well, the lights are on 24 hours. It has to be. But UK, for example, and a lot of places in Scandinavia and even Canada have proven it doesn't actually have to be that way.
Yeah. And what's gratifying to me is that there are more initiatives that are coming down the pike. And I think you follow the money, and there's a lot of healthcare facilities in America are funded by these healthcare real estate investment trusts. They're called REITs. These organizations are looking to give money to healthcare organizations that demonstrate strong environmental and social and governance policies. And so some people in the financial world are saying, well, we're poo-pooing this. It's just a marketing thing. Are they really making money doing this? But I think it's an important thing. I mean, because ESG policies, every healthcare organization has them now. And from a designer standpoint, if you're a designer and you can come to the table and say, I can help you meet those goals with how I design your facility, that's a win-win for a designer.
Yeah, I was speaking to some sustainability consultants the other day, and they said, basically, we should be the first phone call before the design team, because we help work out the KPIs. And if you have a healthy building or a carbon neutral building, you can actually have the potential to save 80, 90% in operational costs, which obviously reduces the operational budget, which actually helps prevent more infections in the environment and help the world and help reduce the cost. So there's all these huge benefits. It's just a matter of the conversation and changing the mindset as well, I think. So I do think Australia's getting there. Certainly it's been a high priority on the agenda for the last few years. And I know a lot of places around Australia at the moment are trying hard to produce Australia's first carbon neutral hospital, which there's a race on at the moment. So it's actually quite an exciting time to be in Australia for that.
Well, and yeah, and I just want to point out too that carbon neutral is great, but I'm talking about more than that in a healthy building. I'm talking about a building that promotes healthy behaviors through its design. That's what I mean by it doesn't harm the health of people or the planet. So the planet is the carbon neutrality and the electricity consumption, but the health of the people is something different. That is something, that is stuff like safety and infection control and well-being, mental health well-being, and how the environment supports all of that. So it's a two-shot thing. It's not just let's be sustainable, but it's also how do we promote the health of the people who are using this building. And like I said, I don't think anybody's truly built the first healthy building yet.
I hadn't even heard of it. So I think we need to do more research on that one. So that's very interesting. What would be a take-home message or something that you would like to see change in the next 30 plus years, considering you've been in the industry for so long?
Oh gosh, something that should be changed. That's a hard question. I think that there's still some misperceptions in the public that come from bad reporting or just inaccurate reporting that these buildings cost a lot of money. They don't. You just have to make the right decisions. And in the end, there's ROI. I always go back to one of the Center for Health Design's board members, Derek Parker, who always said that he could not do his best work without having a client that had the vision, because he couldn't go in and convince them to do something. They had to be willing to take a leap. And so I think that there's still a lacking in leadership, in the understanding of these things that we've sort of talked about here. Certainly healthcare leaders, healthcare CEOs of hospitals and hospital systems in America have a lot of things that they're worrying about. But if they really realized how important the design of the physical environment was to their whole business operations, they would be paying a lot more attention to it. And I still think there's a lack of that in this field. And some of it may be due to public perception, what they read in their local newspaper or see. And maybe it may be the people that they're working with have not enlightened them. But I still think that there's a ways to go in that area.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that's universal as well. Basically, culture comes from the top, and the decision makers are the ones that ultimately need to make those hard calls and be visionary for the future, because if we don't have those hard decisions made now, the design overall will fail and the hospital itself eventually will be challenged as well. So I think that's a really good point. I just want to say thank you for all your hard work over the last 30 years plus. I mean, without the Centre of Health Design, without the world of health research, certainly we would be back in the 1940s hospitals, which is just a brick wall and squares and white walls. So I do think what you've done from the Centre of Health Design has really helped change the world, change America, and certainly change Australia's world of health design. We're a little bit behind, but certainly on a fast trajectory, thanks to you guys paving the way. So thank you very much.
Well, you guys are doing great stuff too. I'm not as familiar with the Australian market, but what I have seen, I think you're doing a lot of good stuff.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for your time. You have been listening to the Australian Health Design Council podcast series, Health Design on the Go. If you'd like to learn more about the AHDC, please connect with us on our website or LinkedIn. Thank you for listening.